today on Rocking the Suburbs.
We talk with Mike Wagner about streaming.
Maybe I should bring an umbrella. Sounds like this could get damp.
All right, Patrick, it's another listener episode today. Another one.
Yeah, fantastic. Keep them rolling.
I know. I mean, we got, you know, we have all these episodes that we're producing, and so why not include the listeners more, right?
That's right. Exactly. We love to hear it. They're smarter than us. They know more than us, and they've been there longer than us. And I will say, our guest today who's with us is an old dear friend who's been with us since the early days, even going back to the old show. So.
Yes, absolutely. So this show is Rocking the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us is...
Mike Wagner.
Hey, Mike. Good to talk to you.
Gentlemen, always good to see you. Always.
Always. You are right. Good to see you.
And I'm not smarter than you. Don't. Trust me. That's
not I'm not smart at all. I just have a lot of records. That's the only thing. Wasn't for that, nobody would ever talk to me.
Judge me by my record collection, as they say.
That's right. I'd be in good shape in that world, yeah.
Okay, so Mike gets to pick the topic today, and you know, Mike's been on before. Listeners are familiar with him. We've talked about some really cool stuff, like Marvin Gaye. Talked about Marvin Gaye before.
That was a really fun episode. Our good friend Nick Scalero joined us for that one.
He did.
That's right. Love that. And what were some of the other topics we've discussed in the past?
Had Steve Gorman on.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
From the Black Crowes, the best band of the 90s.
That's great.
We had the producers of Fleetwood Mac on that one time. That was real fun.
That's right.
That was epic.
You arranged all that stuff. Yeah.
That was really fun. Love that. We talked about Pete Townsend, early 80s Pete Townsend.
Yes.
That was real fun.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A lot of things.
Lots of great topics. So
lots of fun stuff.
All right. So what would you like? This is a little bit different. So what would you like to talk about today?
What I thought would be a really interesting topic is the role of streaming in the music industry. And I'm actually going to take a sort of rather contrarian view, but I think it's founded in the numbers, and we'll kind of go through it. I subscribe to these, not subscribe, but, you know, these feeds about the music industry and, the role of streaming in the industry comes up all the time. I came across this article, and it talked about how the money in the industry started declining in the year 2001. And it actually bottomed out in 2014. As it declined, the main one was the physical product, which really dropped. The digital downloads didn't really compensate for that, and it kept falling. And then about 2014, it started changing. And last year, 2021, was the first time that revenue in music actually outdid 2001. So it took 20 years to recover from 2001. So we talk about streaming, but it's actually been a long-term change in the industry. What the article points out that, like, right now there are 523 million people, that's at the time of this writing of this article, that have a paid music stream, it's kind of hard because Spotify has so many ad-based subscribers as opposed to premium subscribers, like many of us pay for whatever it is, $10 a month or $15 for a family plan or something like that. So there's this kind of conventional wisdom that streaming is ruined the industry, but it was like it was actually starting to fail before streaming even came along. And, you know, and why that was, I think, is actually kind of interesting. Discussion, like, why was it that it kind of declined so rapidly at that time? I mean, I know file sharing was a thing, but my sense is that was actually, yes, that certainly has something to do with it, but I don't think it was in the billions of dollars.
Right.
Maybe it was, and I'm wrong, because it's just like, if you think of the internet back then, it was like, I don't think they could move that many files that fast, and it was kind of a pain, and not everybody did it. You know what I mean? It was like a selection.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I wanted to ask you guys is, like, what do you think actually caused that drop in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I guess when it went to digital downloads, you know, iTunes and stuff like that, right? There was, you know, in MP3s, there was a certain amount of file sharing. I think that was part of it. There was, it sort of led to this belief of like, to some extent, that like, oh, well, music is free now, right? Like we can just,
yeah,
you know, we can rip the stuff from CDs and then trade it with other people or whatever.
Right.
But I also think beyond that too, even within the, you know, the officially licensed downloads, say the stuff you would buy from iTunes, it was 99 cents a song.
Yeah.
So you could just buy the one song that you wanted, right. And the whole model of buying the whole album was starting to be disrupted, right?
Correct. Yes.
So I think that probably had an impact as well.
Well, I think that's actually right. And one of the things I thought of was that, you know, I remember buying CDs in the 90s. It was like hard to find one under $10.99, right? You know, if something new came out and you're kind of like, I don't know about this. I don't, you know, radio wasn't like as big as, you know, making new music exposed like it used to, because there's so many classic rocks and so many, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, there was, but it's like, even in a big city like Houston, it was actually fairly bad radio. It was not, it was hard to find new stuff. And, you know, MTV had kind of lost its power. And CDs were just expensive. And so I think you're right, Jim. I think when it yeah. came like, oh, I heard this song, I like that song, I'll just buy that song. And I'll put it on a playlist on my iPod or something like that, right? So that's like, you went that's from right. spending 10 bucks to a buck, right, for a lot of stuff. I think that's probably a huge part of it.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree with you guys. And I think the other factor that began to happen around that time with the advent of not only more accessible internet connections for every household. I'm trying to think the first time we got a home computer and had a dedicated dial-up line or whatever it was, but I think it precipitated the increase in niche divisions within music, right? I don't think they were as stark before the internet came along, and I think, you know, Napster had something to do with that. But suddenly, you know, you could focus on just hip-hop if you wanted to, right? And like you said, Mike, you could have the classic rock niche, and some people never left that, right? You know, they had their period where they were into the bands, and they never... Whenever it was, we talk about this a lot, when they started a family or whatever it was, their musical taste didn't expand, but that was okay because you can stay right there in that place and that's fine too. And, you know, from blues to punk to whatever, as it went down the line, I think it created these verticals that was hard for mass artists to cross them right. all. Whereas, you know, even before that in the 90s, you had people that crossed all these things. And certainly in the 80s and 70s, there were these much more ubiquitous artists. And like the chart you sent over about the money that Spotify paid out to certain artists, that's a very small percentage of people that made over $1 million, right, of all the artists that are out there. And I think the other contributing factor, and not to take it in a completely different direction, is when the internet started, it quickly facilitated the ability for artists to record at home instead of having to go through the system of being signed by a label, going into a studio, you know, going through all that stuff, signing a contract, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly people could put out their, you know, music for a much smaller amount of people. So I think even in a personal sense, it created these niches that changed, you know, it was a massive crack in the structure of what the music industry was up until that time. That's just the way I see it. And I will say, from my point of view, I think, as you mentioned in there, Mike, too, it's important to try to understand what the more mainstream consumer of music would be. And I think for the three of us, maybe we're not in that group, right? Because we're so obsessive about it. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
We're not.
So it is, you know, I'm probably the person who would chase the carrot that the music industry would dangle in front of me no matter what it was. You know, I'm buying mini discs now, or I'm buying,
there's a record store day and I can get chip. The 7-inch white vinyl.
I'll do it. Yeah, I need to get a chip embedded in my neck to listen to music. Sure. I'm first in line. But I, yeah, that's just kind of how I see right. it coming down.
So are you guys, I guess, well, let me just ask this first off, just as music fans, we all subscribe to a streaming right. service, right? So we obviously are on board with it, with the concept of it or what it you know, what it has to offer. But then at the same time, I mean, was look at, you know, look at Patrick's Basement, you know, he also is a big fan of physical records as well. And I find that a lot of times when I see it, like say on social media, stuff like that, is this sort of, a lot of people take this attitude of like, it's either or,
yes.
you know, like, why don't people, you know, buy more physical media? Streaming is killing music, you know, mm-hmm. so on and so forth, right? And I guess I would ask you, Patrick, like, you know, where do you come down on that? How do the two work together, I guess, for you, right?
It's a really good question, Jim. And I think for me, I've always been of the mindset that whatever and however I can get the music, like, I'll get it on that format, you know? And I love to have albums and I love to hold the physical product of the record, but I've never been a person who's been a, you know, fetishist about the records. Like, if you look at the records that I own that are probably worth money because they're old or rare or whatever, they're not in mint condition in any way, shape, or form. You know, they've got scratches all over them because I played them all the time. And I never have kind of treated them like objects. So, and for me, it's all about finding the music in whatever format it's in. And so I guess in that sense, maybe it's a little selfish or a little blinderish in that, you know, for example, the way I use music streaming services today is to make playlists a lot of times for other people or on a radio show to use it, you know, quickly to put out songs that I think of. But it's an interesting point. And I, you know, I think there's probably something in my mind that thinks about it. And especially, you know, Mike and I both have issued music, you know, for bands and personally never seen a penny from any streaming service that our music has ever been on. But there's a divide, I think, somewhere between the state of the industry and what you can get from it personally. And that's, I've always been on the side of like, I'll take whatever is out there, you know. I mean, if I'm a bottom feeder on the industry and I'm taking all this stuff, I'll take that too. But I think there's a much larger point to be considered and understood about how the health of the industry affects a person like me who maybe suddenly I can't get that music on streaming anymore because the whole model fails or whatever. You know what I mean? So I don't know. It's kind of a dichotomy. But as obsessive as I am about it, I mean, I pay for more than one streaming service every month. So
you only have to pay for one, though, Patrick. You can fix that.
Well, I've found it. Well, it's really an interesting point, and I'll say too that, you know, you mentioned the family plan, and so we have a family plan on one service, and people that I would consider much more mainstream than myself, my three offspring, who like to listen to music and use it regularly, just don't want to change. You know, they're like, oh, I know there's a controversy going on about this one streaming service, and I disagree with it, but I'm set in my ways, and I've got all my playlists. And I know how to use it, and I like the music, and they give me this and this, so I'm not changing. And if you decide to quit, then I'll pay for it myself. But, you know, I think that's part of it, too, is what kind of comfort level have we reached with the way we consume music? And I don't know what you think, Mike and Jim, too, about all the other media that began to be available to us, you know, as the millennium turned. You know, suddenly there was a lot of things that you could do that you couldn't do before. You know, that would take up your time.
I think that's a huge thing. I think there was one thing I think is true, and you kind of know this from other areas, like that's when there's just so many albums starting to be released, right? And so the consumer is facing like all these albums out there, and it's kind of like it becomes overwhelming. And so instead of like in, you know, when we grew up, it was sort of like there was only a few albums released a year.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
And so it was like, and it was actually all bottled, kind of like how did you learn about it? Through the radio. And we all listened to the roughly the same 5, 6, 7 radio stations, right? And so it was like, oh, I like that one. I'll go buy that album. Now it's like you got hundreds, if not thousands. I mean, I'm still talking only 2000s, right? And you're just like, like, how do I know? Like, how am I going to buy this? Like, I think like there's like when you overload and you have so many choices, you end up not making any. Right. I think that's probably yep. some of that happened too. And like you said, that was when,
yep.
you know, people could start making music on their own. I mean, in the 80s, it was like nobody bought microphones and had a computer and could kind of do it themselves. It's just like, that's like, no. I mean, you had a porta scan, you right. know, what do they call them? Not porta potty, but that's what I used. That's what I used to record the porta potty. Yeah. I just went in there and made a racket. And
the acoustics were great for echo.
Every once in a while, there was a strange sound, but whatever. And, but you know, it's like, yeah, I think that started happening. So, and the other thing that I kind of wanted to get into is like, there's this notion, like somehow back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, like those were the good old days and everybody made money. And I'm like,
yeah,
I don't think so. Right. Because like, there's right. like, you watch these documentaries and like, I just watched one on Queen the other night and they were like, they were going in to make the fifth album. I get them backwards. Day at the Races, the one with Bohemian Rhapsody on it. Or Night at the Opera, I forget mm-hmm. which one they're in. Anyway, and it's like, they're like, we were broke. We couldn't get any money. And they yeah. were a successful band. You know, Tom Petty, mm-hmm. same way. He was broke, right? I mean, he was yeah. he had to hide the tapes to make right. Damn the Torpedoes. You know, the Stones right. had to leave England because like they didn't have money to pay. You know, it's
taxes,
like, it's not
yeah.
like it was like this great time for everybody. I mean, there was a few people who made a lot of money, right? But
yep.
it wasn't like there was like dozens upon dozens, right? And it was like the same thing. There's also you had a very tight circle of studio musicians, right? From the Wrecking Crew to mm-hmm. to the people who did, you know, people like I can't think of Larry Carlton, who played on the a lot of the Steely Dan records. That whole, there's like, if you watch these documentaries, there's like Jay Graydon, I think his name is, the guy who played on, he played on Steely Dan. No, these whole circle of studio musicians that everybody would use over and over and over again because they knew they were good
yeah.
because it was so expensive to yep. record. And everybody had to sign these deals, and they were crappy deals because it was so expensive to record. And like, not everybody the record company signed is going to make money, right? So they signed 20 people hoping one will hit. I mean, they're nothing but a venture capital firm.
Right.
Right. And it's like, and then you hit and you're like, where's my money? It's like, oh, wait, you're paying for these other 19 records too.
That's what
you know,
it is.
Like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And it's
right.
like the,
yep.
the people who really made money didn't make it until they sort of made their third, fourth, or fifth successful album. Right. I mean, I'm mm-hmm, sure they made mm-hmm. some. Right. And then depending on who you are and what your deal had, and everybody was different. But we all hear these stories about
right.
all these bands who got screwed. Or they thought they got screwed.
Yep, right.
They probably did, right? Because it's none of, you know, every industry, regardless of what it is, if they can make money off you, they will. Right. And so I think there's this rose colored glasses looking at the past. That's not exactly true. It's true for a certain amount of people who sort of made it through and we still talk about.
Yeah.
But it wasn't true for everybody.
I agree with everything you're saying. I think the one constant, whether it's the quote unquote, you know, good old days, right, and or today, is that there are executives who are making a lot of money.
Yes.
And it used to be the, you know, record labels and I don't know, you know, artist managers and stuff like that. And now maybe it's less the record labels and more the streaming services.
Right.
So the streaming, the guys running the streaming services, the executives in that, you know, they're making
right.
bank. Right. And then, and that's what makes people upset, because then some artists will post like, here's my statement from the streaming services, and here's how little money I got for all these like massive number of plays.
Yeah.
Right. And they get up and people then get all upset about that because they're like, well, this is, you know, somebody else is making a lot of money off this guy's music. And I don't personally like that, of course, but I'm not sure that it's any different than it's ever
well,
been.
Well, I also think it's some of these guys, and like, you know, I don't want to speak for them. And I tried to read up on it and narrow it down, but it seems like a lot of it, what it is that there's this definition between, is it a sale or is it a, like a play on a radio station? And there's actually different payments
yeah.
on that.
Right.
And so the record companies claim, well, it's a sale. And so they get to keep more money. you know, that's the crappy deals they bought, they signed, you know, and I feel bad for them. I wish, like, if there's a young musician out there now, that one thing I've learned that I hear over and over is don't sign anything, right? It's like, don't sign anything.
Well, and that's what I was going to say is the flip side to this is the good part of streaming. I mean, as you started off with, that decline in revenue has reversed. People are paying for music now. Mm-hmm. Now it's, you know, whatever it is, $10 a month or whatever. It may not, may not be a ton of money, but it's some money, right? That is going out there. Right. And people, I'm sure there are accountants who have figured this out. Like, if we keep this price point here, we're going to maximize our subscriptions, right? Yep. If we raise it, we're going to lose some. And so, you know, the pot of money won't be as big after that. So it's not just a question of, you know, jack it up by $5 a month and suddenly we'll have all this more money.
Right.
You know, it's more complicated than that. But consumers are paying for music. It's just different model. But here's the other thing, too. Music has become democratized in some way. As you mentioned, it's easier and cheaper to record now. And because you're not dependent on physical product anymore, the gate has opened wider for distribution, right? So now there's many more artists out there who are reaching into that pot, right? So that's right. So that's a big factor, right?
That's
the whole distribution thing is huge. I mean, a band we all love, and I think most of our listeners love, Big Star, totally got screwed by distribution.
They did, yeah. Yep,
they made these two great records and they couldn't get out there. It's like, just like, it's crazy.
Pull into a town to play and there's no record in the record store. People can't buy it if they want to, right?
And if that were today and they got good word of mouth, everybody can hear it.
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
So absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. And then the third point I want to make, and I don't want to get too deep into all this because I'm not a working musician. And so maybe, you know, I want to believe, of course, the struggle is real. You know, I don't want to diminish that, right? You know, for some people out there, it probably is really hard and can be discouraging, right? But I think the era we grew up in as music fans, we got this false sense of belief that, like, all rock stars, all musicians are multimillionaires.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
That's right.
And I think this is to your point earlier, Mike. Like, I don't think that was the case. And even if in cases where it was the case, it was still, I think, a select few. And it never stopped music from being made. And that's the thing that drives me crazy, right? And I'll even point to, like, even in the heyday, you know, like, say the 70s, the big, big superstar rock era or whatever, right? Major labels were still putting out jazz artists and, you know, classical records and, you know, bluegrass and maybe polka. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, there were whole other divisions of, like, more niche music, and none of those guys were getting rich, but they were still making music. You know, like, music survives kind of no matter what, you know, in some of the worst horrible circumstances in the world, people make music. You know what I mean? So, you know, so I guess, like I said, I want musicians to get, I mean, I think we all want them to, you know, make decent amount of money and not live in poverty and all of that. But at the same time, I can't get too upset that there aren't, like, more Rod Stewarts. Like, you know, I think we'll be fine, right? Everybody will be fine.
To your point, Mike, when you were talking about everybody's deal is different and don't sign anything, et cetera, et cetera. Part of that is the fact that maybe there will one day, but certainly right now, there's no way for a group of musicians or a representative group to form together in a union of some kind to negotiate with Spotify or Apple or anybody like that to improve the terms of the profit sharing, right? Because everybody's got their own deal and they've got their own label. So the labels are doing the negotiating. The rights holders for the copyrights are doing the negotiating with the streaming services. So there's no way to, you know, come together as a force and say, well, Beyonce and all these other people are going to pull their music off of here unless we get X deal. There's no way to do that because it's all fragmented in all a certain deal. And yet I still think somewhere deep down, to Jim's point, in musicians' minds, like you were saying, there's always that one moment where it's like, a man in a really nice camper wants to put our record on the radio. I'll sign, you know, whatever it is.
I love that guy.
Right. Because you've got those stars in your eyes, right? And you feel like, okay, if I just do this, then everything's going to fall into place. And in many cases, you know, as we know, it goes in the opposite direction. But that's part of the magic and DNA of making real music, I think, is that one day you sort of see, this is my chance, you know? And certainly things are totally different. I mean, you look at Chance the Rapper, he's never really been affiliated with a label in any way. He's kind of done it himself, but I don't know.
I was just going to interject something there, Patrick, because you were talking about, you know, and tying on what Jim was saying by trying to make it. And one thing I wanted to point it out is like,
yeah.
Do you know how many songs are uploaded to Spotify every single day?
I know. It's crazy.
60,000 songs are uploaded every single day.
Every day. I'm never going to be able to listen to all those.
But you'll give it the old college try, and Scott Parks will buy single vinyl that comes out.
he's out there leading the way. Yeah.
Follow me. I know he's leading the charge. And but it's like the reality of it is, it's like the good news is everybody gets to make music. The bad news is everybody gets to make music. I mean, look, it's 60,000 songs a day. I mean, it's like, you know, you're saying I've made stuff and it's like, you just have to get over this notion, like a lot. And I think we talked about this a little bit when I was there in DC a couple months back. It's like, there's a certain amount of it feels privileged but it's like, I can do it, right? I can make music. Mm-hmm. And you hear a lot of people say, well, it doesn't matter the sales. What matters is the art. I'm like, until the money matters, right? I mean, but there is a certain amount of the way I feel about it is like, at least I get to make music, right? I could not do this when I was, you know, back in the 90s when we were playing in clubs and stuff. It's like, all I really wanted to do, I didn't want to play in clubs. I don't like really playing live. I like making music on an album and making, you know, like, yeah, that's what I love. Yeah. And I can do it now. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not
crafting it in the studio.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not cost prohibitive. Right. I mean, is anybody going to listen to it? You know, probably not, you know? And it's like, because part of the reason is because there's 60,000 songs every day. I mean, think about what you guys do. You every month you have 3, 4, 5, 6 days dedicated to new music. And then the next there's a whole nother bit. And the next month there's a whole nother bit.
Right.
And it's like,
right. And those are great songs.
I mean, and the other thing is, it's like, you know, I was just watching a show and they were talking about some song was on Guardians, is that I'm so ignorant. Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. Guardians.
And it's like, it was Redbone, Come and Get Your Love. And it's like, and all of a sudden they got 3 million listeners a month.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, and you're competing against that too. You're competing against Queen.
Right.
I think a lot of our kids love Queen. My kids love Queen. Right. You're competing against that.
That's a great point. And think about Kate Bush suddenly coming back to number one out of nowhere. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah.
From Stranger Things.
Stranger Things.
That song. Well, and all of a sudden, it's like everybody's listening to Kate Bush.
Yeah.
But you can do that. But here's the difference with the streaming as opposed to the past. It's like immediately accessible to you.
That's right.
If you're like never heard Kate Bush before, you watch the TV show, you see that, you're like, that's a good song. Boom. You go listen to it. You save it. You listen to more of her stuff, all of that, you know? So
yeah, you can go listen to all of her albums if you want to.
I ultimately think it's a good thing. And I think for me personally, you know, I use it a lot to just listen to stuff that I don't have, that I'm curious about, or even like legacy artists, those gaps in my collection that I don't have, you know, album X, Y, and Z. And I want to hear what those are about. I personally still, you know, buy a certain amount of physical stuff because probably selfishly because I just kind of enjoy the experience of it and I like to have it, but always in the back of my mind I always kind of feel like, well, for the artist I really like, this helps them out a little bit more, you know?
Yes.
That kind of thing, right? But I think ultimately I think the two work together really well, streaming and physical media. Mm-hmm. And you can and that's one way to look at it, but then I think at the end of the day it almost doesn't matter. Any of this almost doesn't matter because you can complain about it all you want. it's just the way the business is going. Like, I don't know what.
I think you're right that it's in some ways it's there's in some ways it's better because it is still a very bad tale of like who gets the lion's share of the money. But I don't. But yes. what I think we're seeing is in looking at the actual numbers, is that it's actually becoming. You can actually make, for lack of a better term, a middle class living a little bit easier. Right?
I think that might be true.
You
yeah.
can get
yeah.
on, and if you're a band, and I mean, it's hard. Like, look, it's really hard. Right? This industry has always been hard, and it's always going to be hard. But, you know, looking at the spot, just what Spotify paid. Now, this is what they paid out. Now, what you get is a different question, right? What the artist gets, the artist gets, it's a different question. And I can't control that. But like I said, a lot of people are doing the CD Baby thing and other outlets like that. But they paid 50,000 artists $10,000 a year, like $10,000. And there was, you know, 7,000 artists who made $100,000 plus. That's a lot of artists, right? I mean, granted, it's worldwide, but that's a lot. And then you consider the other streaming services, you know, Apple, Tidal, Amazon starting to come in. That's going to add up. Are you going to be rich?
Mm-hmm.
No. No, you're not. And, you know, and like I think what you spoke to earlier is like this notion that you know, the person who had a number one hit in 1972, you know, I don't think whoever did the backing vocals on Sugar Sugar by the Archies is living off that money right now. I think that's just, you know, that's probably not happening. You know, the songwriter and the you know, whoever that is probably still doing all right. But one thing if this gets to any streaming service, what I really think would be better for artists and small time artists is to, as part of your monthly subscription, is if you can add, like, even if it's a dollar, right? And then you can go and you can say, okay, give this artist that dollar this month, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think instead of focusing on like getting $20 t-shirts to everybody, which is like a pain, right? Merch is a pain, right? Because it's like, you got to get it to the person. Yes, you can do it online, but then you don't get any of that money. You know, it's just like, it's all this stuff. But like, if you can cut the middle, all that out and just go like, okay, even if it's 50 cents and say you have 10,000 people and you're a band who has 10,000 people and it's like, it's like, that's nothing. Right. Considering that Spotify has 400 million listeners. I mean, that's like nothing. But if you get, you know, if you get an extra, you know, couple hundred bucks a month for, you know, a little band, it's like, it, you know, it pays for something. Right. You know, it's like money directly in the pocket. And I would like to see some way that they can do some sort of micro payments as opposed to going for selling big, you know, big ticket items to people, because it's just harder, right? Hmm. But just,
it's interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think one argument totally in favor of that too is that you're there on the streaming services now. Yes, I could go and find the band's website, and I could see if they have a Patreon or if they have some way on Bandcamp. But that's a lot of work, and I'm listening to the music right now on my phone on the streaming service. And if I could just hit a button and designate them to get 50 cents a month or whatever, yes, I think that would work. But I want to say, bring up one example, and I know we're getting close on time, but remember the band Kid Brother that all three of us interviewed, right? And they had a great following. They had tremendous chemistry, that band. I mean, that band really had charisma when they were playing together.
And they just released something, I think.
Yeah, and they had people that came out and watch them whenever they played. They got good support, and they seemed like they always had a lot of fun on stage. And yet, they were all working full-time jobs, right? And they were doing the music part-time. And I think as a musician, like you said, Mike and Jim, that it's you can make the music. You can have that kind of thing. But at a certain point as a musician, you have to ask yourself, what lifestyle or what situation am I comfortable with within this, you know, situation of being a musician? Do I want to make it full time and make it my whole job? And if I do, what kind of cost of living threshold am I willing to live with? You know, I go back to that Wilco documentary even. I'm not trying to break your heart, where Jeff Tweedy's in Wendy's and he doesn't even have any money to like buy Wendy's. Right? He has no money in his pockets. But what do you, are you happy going on tour once a year and working your job and, you know, taking a couple weeks off? Or like, what is it, at what level do you want to commune with commerce and art together? And they seemed very happy, and I wish them all the luck in the world, and I'm glad they're still putting stuff out. I can't answer the question if they're happy with it, but, you know, they seemed like
it. I just checked. They have 50,000 monthly listeners.
Look at that. That's fantastic. I mean, to me, I would feel like I was the biggest star in the world if I had 50,000 monthly listeners.
If I had 50, I'd be thrilled, you know?
Yes. I know.
I mean, like, it's, I know. Like, is that going to make them a living? No. It's just not, right? It's just not.
Not on streaming revenue alone, certainly
no,
not.
No, I mean, yeah, and right. they're going to have to build up, you know. I mean, that's kind of one of the other thing that I think a lot about, that what the downside of it is that it's really, really hard for artists to make great records. It's much harder now than it was. It's easy to make a good record. You don't have the production and engineering support that used to be there. Another thing, I mean, like you couldn't have a George Martin hanging out with you all the time now, right? And helping you.
Yeah,
you right. can't have a great, you know, like, I don't know if any listeners know who Shelly Yakis is, but he is a great engineer from, like, he was really responsible for the sound of Damn the Torpedoes, that really big drum sound, and, like, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, when you go to make a record, you're like, and you sort of go and you record and you kind of go back and listen and you compare yourself to something, you're like, oh man, it's just not the same. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's just not, you know, and you're like, well, what am I doing wrong? Or how do I get there? And it's like, you know, if there's one thing that worries me about it, is it's that, because it makes it harder to compete against those like, because, like, you know, to kids today, Queen is as new as my kid brother. Right? I mean, they don't know the difference.
Right, right.
You know, and it's like, it's, you know, and you, like, you watch the documentaries on what they did to make Bohemian Rhapsody, you're like, holy crud. You know, it's like, but they didn't have ability to do that on their own when they got started, you know, and it's really hard to learn that. It's really hard to be a really great engineer, you know? It's like, that's the one thing that worries me. I think in my note, I put, like, The best are lucky because I don't remember the guy's name, the lead guitar player is also the engineer, but he really knows how to do it. Mm-hmm. He's a great engineer, and so their records sound amazing, right?
You know, you're right. You're right.
That's a good point.
Occasionally, but this is pretty rare, occasionally there's the home musician who just has the right touch.
Yeah.
Who gets it. I think of Car Seat Headrest as one of those two.
Yeah,
like,
there you go.
That's all. That was all Will Toledo and, like, home recordings and stuff like that. But, man, they have those records have such a big sound to them. I don't know how he did it, but he just obviously, you know, has that that right touch, I guess. But it's rare. Yeah, you're right. You don't get that same kind of support because you can't afford it. I guess, you know.
That's right.
And so
yeah.
Anyway, it just doesn't work.
I'm hopeful that you know, it comes around to where, like, you know, like, you can, like, if it does change and artists figure out how to sign better deals and don't give away all the money, and then it kind of changes, you know, because I think some bands did figure out, like, how not to, you know, give away the farm. And I think I put it in my notes, like, U2 and REM, and the, you know, they were, you know, started later than the bands who got screwed. And it seems like they always had good management and they were always financially secure. Right. And so they could do what they wanted to do. Do you know what I mean? And they ended up making, you know, unbelievably great records, all of them, right? You know, and it wasn't like they were like huge, massive productions, right? They didn't do, to reference a former guest, Tusk, and, you know, spend a year in the studio. You know, they went in, they made it. I mean, yeah, I think U2 probably spent a lot of money on Octoon Baby, but, you know, I don't think that, you know, the Joshua Tree was, I think, recorded roughly in the same place they recorded the first album, you know, but they got better, you know, they had good engineers along the way. Same with REM. They had Mitch Easter. Like, great stuff, right? And I'm hoping that's what happens going forward. You know what I mean? So that's kind of my hope.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is This has been really interesting,
too much
right? There's
thinking.
So many. I know.
I hurt my brain.
And there's so many.
Yeah,
I don't have a big brain to start
there's
with.
There's so many. There's so many directions this could go off in. So yeah. we could talk about this forever.
I bet the comments will be quite large on this one. So
I can't wait. Yeah.
When you hang out with us and have beers, Mike, this is the kind of stuff we'll talk about further.
Late into the night. Yeah.
That's right. All right. Thanks very much, Mike Wagner.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, guys. Always love it.
Always a good
topic. For anybody who has comments on streaming, is streaming killing music, or is it this new life raft, I guess? Let us know. Call
612-440-1984.
Yep, and leave a message there or email us rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @suburbspod. All right, let's get out of here. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And I'm Mike Wagner.
And we'll talk to you all later. You should be going. You never leave. Reverse the roles and all the doors are closed on me. See, present a cure you down the dose and self-belief. Alone this morning, from past away, I heard the ghost of words and leave respects on pain. A stolen moment, somewhere unseen. To walk this line, I always have to steal relief. I'm falling down. We're all falling down. You cut the story. Good stuff.